note for anyone that was offended by my comments, I certainly apologize. There was no ill will, no intent whatsoever. I also recognize that this comment was twisted and it was turned into a weapon to be used against me, a political weapon used for nothing but personal and political gain by my opponent. That's the type of politics Mississippians are sick and tired of.
Mississippi Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith apologizing, sort of, for controversial remarks she made while on the campaign trail earlier this month. Hyde-Smith was caught on tape saying that if one of her big supporters invited her to a public hanging, she'd be there in the front row. Mississippi, of course, has a notorious history of lynching Black people. Hyde-Smith's comment and the fallout since has thrown what should have been a very easy win for her in today's election into some doubt. After those comments today, there were seven nooses found hanging at the Capitol building in Jackson. Her opponent is Black. His name is Mike Espy, and the Democratic Party is now hoping he will pull off an upset. Here to talk about this is Marvin King. He teaches American politics at Ole Miss in Mississippi. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so it's great to have you. She made those comments in early November, and they weren't reported for several days, but then they were. What happened after that?
Well, what happened after that is people like me are talking on radio shows in Canada and Los Angeles. The attention has been enormous, and people are paying attention to a race that otherwise would not garner much national attention at all.
Right, and some big companies have asked for their money back that they donated to her campaign, like Walmart, Aetna, AT&T. Mm-hmm. Do you think that this is going to cost her the election?
No. It might cost her the election if she was in some other states, but I don't think in Mississippi those sorts of comments are disqualifying. They might in other places, but not here.
And President Trump campaigned for her at two rallies yesterday, so I imagine he's pretty popular in the state as well.
He's very popular. I know he's strongly approved by about 40% of the state, and his overall approval ratings are about 56%. So he's fairly popular here, and he knows that he can come here and have that strong base of support that will support him no matter what.
Still, there is a large African-American voting bloc, which is, I understand, about 90% plus for Mike Espy. Is this going to be a question of turnout? Like, if enough African-Americans turn out to vote, could that turn the race?
Well, anything is possible, but you have to remember, even when Obama was on the ballot, he only carried in the low 40s. And so the trick for Democrats here is getting about 25% of the white vote. Typically, they can get about 15% of the white vote. And so Democrats need to get about 25% of the white vote. And so the real question is, those comments by Cindy Hyde-Smith will certainly galvanize more Blacks to turn out. And I think they'll galvanize some independents maybe to vote for Espy. And some Republicans might stay home, but Republicans generally start with, for these statewide races, about 100, 150,000 vote head start. And that's why Espy is going into such strong headwinds. It's a very large deficit he begins with.
So as you say, this has garnered national, international attention. But what does it say about Mississippi, this controversy, to you?
Well, it says that Mississippi... that Mississippi is still part of the old South. We're not the new South. You know, when you think of places like Charlotte or Atlanta or Nashville, where you could kind of plop those cities anywhere in the country and not realize you're in the South. That's not the case when you visit here. And so comments like what she made, I think, get brushed off in a place like this, whereas in other places it would be more damaging.
Well, how has Mississippi, I guess, been able to retain its old South status and resist the forces of change?
That's a great question. Mainly from a lack of turnover, if you will. We have among the lowest amount of in-migration, other Americans moving across state lines, and we have among the lowest levels of foreign migration of any state. And so what that means is, you know, our population changes the least. And so when that happens, almost by definition, if you're already a conservative state and the people who make up your population don't really change, you're not going to get political change. And so, you know, some of those most egregious stereotypes of the Old South. We don't have those anymore, but, you know, we get nooses on Capitol lawns on election days, and, you know, we still have a Confederate emblem on our state flag, so we have Confederate statuary all over the place. You know, so you have some of those very visible symbols, which maybe aren't attractive to people, and so that's why we don't get, you know, that in-migration and foreign migration that some of the other states get that then leads to economic development and political development.
And talk a little bit about the history, really awful history, troubling history of lynching in Mississippi. I understand it has the most amount of any state in its history. And, of course, Emmett Till was lynched in 1955 in Mississippi. He was 14 years old. There was a hanging recently in the last year that some think was a lynching.
That's right. You know, we do have this history. It's what's most challenging about it here, I believe, is getting attention shown on this issue to people as they're growing up. Folks who are in the education community have had a devil of a time getting civil rights issues sort of taught in the K-12 curriculum, and so I think you have a large population here that doesn't realize Mississippi's own history. And so when these things happen, it furthers the stereotype that many people already have of the state. And a lot of locals, natives, may not realize that the state just kind of plays into those stereotypes, and the state, you know, has to deal with that burden. And so we do have these things. We had an incident here at the University of Mississippi many years ago, where somebody put a student put a noose on the statue of James Meredith, who had integrated the school. And so we seem to go through these things every couple of years. And you know, the only thing I would say is maybe it's more disappointing when the comments come from your elected leaders.
Mm. Okay, so but there seems to be a pushback, a pretty strong pushback, at least in the form of Mike Espy's campaign and maybe African American civil liberties.
There is. I mean, and that's I think it speaks, though, honestly, more of how America has changed and less of how Mississippi has changed. You do have a lot of advocacy groups here on the ground helping Mike Espy, and they're paying attention to the race, and you're seeing these national organizations, you know, ask for their money back. But if you look at the core base of the Mississippi voter, the only way to know will be tonight when we see the election results. If Espy wins, then I'm wrong, but I don't think I'll be wrong. I think Espy will lose by a margin that Democrats typically lose by, and what that'll show me is that, you know, the large voting block of white Mississippians are unperturbed by those comments, and, you know, they're willing to just brush it off as, you know, a gaffe or a mistake or nothing worth apologizing for. So the change that you speak of is, I think, more American than Mississippi.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Marvin King. He teaches American politics at the University of Mississippi. Coming up, LA Times columnist Steve Lopez is here to talk about his new series on children living in poverty right here in Los Angeles. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There are about 15,000 children in LA's public schools who are homeless, and one school has more than any other, Telfair Elementary in Pacoima. A quarter of the students there are homeless. LA Times columnist Steve Lopez has a new series about child poverty and homelessness. He and a photographer named Francine Orr spent 2 months at Telfair Elementary and the surrounding neighborhood, and he's here now to talk about it. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. Okay, well, tell us about a woman that you followed. Her name is Brenda Salgado. She's 29 years old. She has four kids, and she was living in a motel.
Yeah, which is not all that uncommon. Lots of families in LA Unified are living in motels. You know what? We should clarify, first of all, what LA Unified is calling homeless. They're not on the sidewalk. They're not in tents. Students, their parents have to fill out a questionnaire. It's a residency questionnaire at the beginning of the year, and you have to check a box. Do you live in your own home, or do you share space or rent space in somebody's apartment or a home other than your own? Do you live in a motel? Do you live in a shelter? The reason they ask this question is because there are some resources available for families that check those boxes. And so at Telfair, which had last year, I think about 760 students, 182 of them checked boxes that said they were in motels or garages or shelters or, you know, housing was up in the air. Mm-hmm. So, that is more, not just proportionally, that number, 180 plus, is more than any other school, even though there are schools that are much larger.
Wow. So why? Why does Pacoima, why does it have so many homeless kids?
It's a poor community. It is surrounded by houses that have garages. And in this economy, you know, a lot of people are making money by renting out their garages or rooms of their houses. I talked to one real estate agent who sold a house to somebody, a four-bedroom house, and the guy is getting $750 per bedroom. And I think it was $900 if you took the bedroom that has its own bathroom. So
wow.
Something about the design of the houses in that neighborhood, there are single-family homes that have become multiple-family homes. And, you know, there was always some of this in L.A. and in California, but it seems as though in that neighborhood there's a concentration of people living in garages.
And, in fact, the principal grew up or spent part of his childhood living in a garage.
Yeah, the principal, Jose Raza, who is one of my newest L.A. heroes, grew up in the neighborhood, went to neighborhood schools, not to Telfair. He went to Haddon Elementary, which is just down the road. But, it was just his mom taking care of him and his siblings. And they moved around a lot. And for a while, they lived in a garage. And in his case, the garage had no bathroom. Mr. Razzo tells this story about when you had to go to the bathroom, you had to go out of the garage, walk around, go up to the front door of the house, knock on the door and ask the owner for permission to use the bathroom. And Jose's older sister, Maria, said that they were told, do not knock after 8 p.m. You got to hold it until the morning. So he is very much aware of the plight of his many students who are living in substandard conditions.
Mm. So how is he trying to help them?
I mean, this sounds pretty depressing.
Yeah.
But what I got at that school was a feeling of hope and a community of people trying to do their best. And by that, I mean the staff, the teachers, the principal. I mean, they've got college banners hanging everywhere in that school. And Mr. Razzo knows that the odds are against these kids because of the homes they're coming from. And so many of them are dealing with, various forms of trauma. But he thinks that his role is to make every single one of them know that he believes in them, that he grew up in those conditions and he made it, and he believes that each of them can make it too. And that's part of the hope of that school. And, there were days I would walk away just feeling inspired. And the other thing about working on this project that I really enjoyed was that it felt liberating because so much of the conversation about schools in California, in L.A., in America, are the civil wars about charter schools versus traditional schools and battles between teachers' unions and administrators and political elections to try to take control of boards. And, you know, this was a break from all of that. It was just a school trying to get through the day, dealing with kids who have a lot of different challenges. And that part of it felt good. I felt like I was getting a better look at the issues of poverty and their impact on, you know, a school's performance than I could have working from a distance as I usually do.
Mm. Still, it is systemic, the problems, right? And they need to be solved high
yeah.
up, right?
Yeah, I think that another takeaway for me is that you would look at the test scores at Telfair and judge this school a failure. It's slightly below LA Unified averages on math and English skills. It's below the state average. So you look at that and we kind of wring our hands and, oh, we got to do something about this school. And it seemed more clear to me in working on this story that the real issue is outside the schools, and the schools are not failing, but we're failing the schools. Because you have in the neighborhood around Telfair a history of the death of living wage jobs. You have the death of GM. You have the demise of Lockheed Martin, of Rocketdyne, of all of these places where even if Telfair families didn't work there, they worked in the ripple economy. And, you know, the best little snapshot of how that neighborhood has changed is that just a couple of blocks away from Telfair on San Fernando Road was Price Pfister, which manufactured kitchen faucets. And it moved production in 1997 to Mexico. And in its place, there is now a Lowe's home improvement store that sells the products that are made by Price Pfister in Mexico. And so what were union jobs that paid a living wage are now closer to minimum wage jobs at Lowe's. And so I think that that is not just a Pacoima story. It's not just a Northeast San Fernando Valley story. I think it's the story of Los Angeles and of California.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have this economic disparity that lands in the neighborhood school, and we expect the schools to somehow rectify this, to turn out a bunch of college-bound kids. And it just felt more than ever before in working on this project that the problem is not the schools, the problem is everything around the schools.
You can read the entire series at the LA Times. Four stories on the Telfair Elementary School in Pacoima. Steve Lopez, columnist for the LA Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, the making of the HBO series My Brilliant Friend, set in Naples and revolving around two young girls.
We had to cast people who could speak Neapolitan, and there just isn't the kind of pool of actors to pull from. And so it really became just this wide-ranging search. Saw over 9,000 girls.
How Elena Ferrante's popular novel was adapted for TV, that's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so that means it's time for our TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
No one told you that was...
This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are four myths. The actual retail price is...
Today, we're going to talk about the HBO series My Brilliant Friend. It's an adaptation of the Italian novel by Elena Ferrante. That novel was the first of four called the Neapolitan novels because they take place in Naples, beginning just after World War II. The main characters are two girls, Lila and Lenu. The novels track their lives over the decades from the point of view of Lenu, who's writing about Lila, her brilliant friend. The books are intimate portraits of the girls' lives and their relationship, but they also serve as a sweeping history of post-war Italy. Readers around the world have been obsessed. Over 10 million copies have sold in 40 countries. And the author, Elena Ferrante, never gives in-person interviews or attends award ceremonies. Few people know who she is. But she gave the green light to this series and was even involved in the writing and casting process. And she chose the director, a 43-year-old Italian named Saverio Costanzo. We're going to speak with Ferrante's American translator in a moment. First, though, executive producer of My Brilliant Friend, Jennifer Schur, joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. So I understand you were a huge fan.
Yes.
Before all of this happened, you were reading the novels. Mm-hmm. And so you thought to yourself, hey, they would make a good TV series?
Well, I tend to try to separate out my pleasure reading from my work reading. Uh-huh. So I wasn't necessarily reading with that eye, but there were definitely parts of it where I thought there is enough here, there is a rich enough world here to build out an entire series of television. But learned shortly thereafter that the Italians already had that idea, and they were going to make that for Italian television in Italy, and an American adaptation would never be allowed to be done.
Never allowed? By whom?
By Ms. Ferrante herself.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the books are quintessentially Italian.
Yeah.
And to honor them, I think, you know, I think that was the proper stance to take.
Right. Okay. So then what was the process of getting them to HBO?
So that, after the Italians had been working on it for a while, they realized that with the international appeal of the books, that there was probably a larger audience for this outside of Italy. And so seeing the worldwide potential for a series like this, they decided to sell to an American outlet. And that is when I got involved. At that point, they went looking for an American writer, producer who could be involved in the mix, you know, be a sort of intermediary between the Italians and any sort of buyer on the American side. And from there, once I was hired, then HBO came on board. And after, there was a lot of interest in the show, obviously, from a lot of buyers, but their passion for the project won out at the end of the day.
And then talk about the director. He's fairly young, mm-hmm. 43 years old. Mm-hmm. And Elena Ferrante said it's got to be him.
She did. That was her choice. And there was never anyone else in the mix. They had had a brief relationship, not personal relationship, but a professional relationship about 5-7 years before that. He had wanted to adapt one of her short stories or a novella into a feature film. He was never able to sort of make that come to life, but she remembered him when it came time to decide who was going to be the shepherd of these phenomenal books. And she said, that is my guy.
And what was it about him that she liked?
You know, I think if you look at his body of work, he tells these very intimate, sort of haunting psychological stories. And I think that really serves a story like this well, that has all of the sweep of an epic, but at the same time, it's about these girls who are at its heart, you know, and their interior lives. So I think she probably felt that he had a good grasp of how to do that on film. And then if you meet him, he is just the most sensitive, gentle, loving gentleman that you could ever meet. And I think she also felt like it was in good hands on that front as well.
Mm. So this is interesting because it is a story about girls who then become women. But the central characters are female, mm-hmm. and he's a guy. So was there any concern that, oh, he wouldn't quite get the interior lives of these girls?
You know, I think that on the surface, I can understand that concern. But once we really started to have discussions about the material, I realized very quickly that this was something that he was throwing his entire self into and bringing to life. And so it wasn't something that concern did not linger for very long. There's multiple parts of being a director as well. It's not just being able to really grasp the material at hand. It's also being able to work with actors, and in this case, work with non-professional young actors, child actors who had never done anything like this before, to be able to have the kind of temperament and patience and build that trust with them that, you know, those are also parts of that job that aren't just about can he bring this world to life. And then if you watch the show, I think you can see that he absolutely has a grasp on the material,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and was able to, you know, flesh that out.
Those two little girls are incredible. Mm-hmm. And they hadn't acted before?
Never. None of the four girls who play Lila and Lenu throughout the first season had ever had any professional acting experience. One girl had taken a few acting classes and wanted to be an actress, but they are all brand new to this, and they are able, you know, the performances that Saverio was able to get out of them are incredible.
Was that part of it, that he wanted to go with non-actors or actors, people who hadn't acted before?
No, I'm sure he probably would have preferred people with experience. We had to cast people who could speak Neapolitan, which is a very specific
dialect
in the south of Italy. And so there isn't a huge wealth of actors who can speak that language. I mean, that language is, the dialect is so different from proper Italian that the show actually airs subtitled in Italy as well. So you have to have someone who can speak that language, and there just isn't the kind of pool of actors to pull from there. And so it really became just this wide-ranging search. I think we saw over 9,000 girls for the parts. It took about 8 months. But at the end of the day, I think what we ended up with is incredible.
Wow.
It's magic.
And they also had to look the part.
Of course. And they had to have core. I mean, part of when you're casting non-professional actors, they have to have some sort of core quality mm-hmm. to the character that you're trying to bring on screen. And so, you know, you're looking for that as well. You're looking for that sort of fierce, almost animalistic quality in Lila. And then a sort of a little more reserved, observant, quieter characteristic in Lenu. And so those are the kind of things that you're looking for. And that's hard to find.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this season is the first novel. Mm-hmm. Will there be more for the subsequent novels?
That is the hope. That is the design. Whether or not we get the opportunity to do it remains to be seen. But yes, the plan is to do 4 seasons, each novel being a season.
And it depends on what, the financing?
Yeah. You know, in success, we will get to do that.
And Ferrante has said yes to all 4?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. All right. Well, fingers crossed.
Yeah, agreed.
Jennifer Scherer, executive producer of My Brilliant Friend. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Another person who worked on this project is Anne Goldstein. She's a translator of Italian literature, and she translated Elena Ferrante's novels. She joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, when did you first hear about this idea to try to make this work, these novels, into a TV show?
I don't remember. I think it was probably quite a few years ago.
Did you think it was a good idea at the time?
I never think it's a good idea to make a... you know, make a film or a TV show, I guess, out of anything. But that's my narrow-minded literary self. But I, you know, I guess I got used to it when it was actually happening. And I think what helped me most, or what made me most interested in it, I guess you could say, is that I guess I was talking to the editors, and they said that Ferrante herself felt that her books were her books, and they would always remain her books. This was a new idea, a new concept.
So separate from the books, in a way.
Yes, yeah.
Although, as someone who has read all the novels, it's very hard to do that, to approach it separately and to
well,
not
of course.
Bring your own.
Yeah, it's really kind of a mental thing, not something that you feel when you're watching them, obviously.
Yeah. So when you were reading the screenplays, what were you thinking in terms of how it didn't or did conform to the novels?
Well, again, you know, at first I was sort of like, well, this didn't happen then, and these events weren't quite like this. And the screenplays changed a lot. I mean, most of them, especially the first ones and the last ones, had quite a lot of revisions. So they sort of changed, some becoming closer to the novels and some becoming less close to the novels. But basically, now as I've been watching them, I mean, although the events seem very compressed, they do seem pretty close to the novels.
Mm-hmm. They do. And what about the girls themselves? Are they how you imagined them when you were reading the work and translating it?
No, not really. I mean, you know, in some ways they are. I mean, they're sort of, you couldn't imagine, in a way, better actresses, especially the little girls. But I guess you always have your own idea about characters. I mean, your own picture of characters, and they don't quite conform to that. And I don't really think that the physical images have gotten in the way of my ideas of the characters.
I guess it's also a different form of translation than from what you do, right? I mean, it's
absolutely
a translation onto the screen.
Yeah, into something visual. Well, in this case, actually, both visual and audio, because the fact that Ferrante doesn't actually write in dialect, in Neapolitan dialect. However, in the films, the characters actually speak in dialect.
So do you speak the Neapolitan dialect? Do you understand it?
No. I mean, I can read it. I can work it out when I read it, but I can't understand it. No.
So it's a lot different than Italian.
It's sort of recognizable, but different.
Can you give me an example of how they differ, maybe a sentence?
Well, for example, the word that you hear actually Lila say quite a lot is ca, which means here, but qua in Italian. Or io sac, which is I know, which is io so in Italian. So if you know, actually, if you know Latin or Greek, even a little bit, and Italian, you can sort of work it out.
So what exactly did you do on this production when it came to translating into English?
I mean, I worked for the Italians, but HBO needed to read the screenplays in English. So I translated them and gave them to the Italians, and then they sent them to HBO. Then various people, I guess HBO and the screenwriters themselves, and Ferrante also, I think, had a lot of input. You know, everybody would say what they thought about that version, and then they would send it back to me, and I would translate it again. I mean, they would correct it, and then I would translate it, the corrections. And then for the first two episodes, I actually, what they called, supervised the subtitles. So I sort of edited the subtitles.
And did you work with Ferrante on translating the scripts? Or was that separate?
No, I just did it. I mean, I just did it the way I've translated her books, actually, which is that I don't really work with her. I mean, if I have questions, I ask the editors and they ask her, but we don't really get together.
Yeah, she doesn't really get together with anyone.
Anybody. I mean, yeah.
I mean, probably aside from her friends and family. But you were in contact with her while you were translating, right? I guess over email or something?
I haven't actually been in direct contact with her. I get in touch with her through the editors, her Italian editors.
So it's secondhand or?
So if I have questions, if there was something that was, you know, I didn't understand, I would ask someone at the publishers. And either they would know or they would ask her.
So this is a really cloistered world, at least in the early novels. This neighborhood in Naples, the characters rarely leave. This is post-war Italy. What do you think the key is in making us, the viewers and the readers, feel like we're actually in it, in this world, and not just outside and observing it?
Well, I think that although the stories are, I mean, in the novels and in the TV series, the stories are very, the story is very particular in the way in that little bit of Naples, as you say, this kind of very closed little neighborhood of Naples. The fact is that the relationships between the people are relationships I'd say that everybody has. I mean, we have mothers and fathers, we have lovers or husbands or children, or we are children of. So, and I think this is one of the things, one of the reasons that these novels had such an appeal, is that, you know, we do recognize ourselves to some extent, or in some way there's some emotional connection that we have to the characters. Somehow she has this ability to be particular and general at the same time.
Yeah, and also an ability to move plot along. So you're sort of hanging on every development.
I know. she's amazing. Well, she talks about that in the Frontumalia, about how she wants to write in a way that people will read. They'll turn the page.
Right, and so in that sense, they're kind of made for TV in that sense.
I guess it's true. Yeah.
Well, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's Anne Goldstein, the translator of Elena Ferrante's novels. The series, My Brilliant Friend, airs every Sunday and Monday on HBO. Coming up on the program, mixing Chinese and American fast food, Chef Shirley Chung is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Shirley Chung is a Chinese chef who likes to rebel against tradition. So she makes mochi donuts, cheeseburger pot stickers, vegan dumplings with spicy tofu aioli. She's been making dumplings since she was 6 years old in her native Beijing. She immigrated to the United States when she was 17 and soon after worked for celebrity chefs Jose Andres and Thomas Keller. And she is somewhat of a celebrity now herself. She's been on Top Chef twice. Here she is on season 14 in Charleston.
So today I made oil poached grouper with a mi and bon herbal tea consomme, collard greens, and cracklings. This plate is for my grandmother and my grandfather. I hope this plate represents my heritage at the same time as my journey in Charleston.
One of the major things that I love about Southern cooking is the aroma. It just like intoxicates you, and it's like someone gives you a hug almost. As soon as they poured that broth, that's where my brain went. So very well done.
Shirley, this dish is such a perfect example of your ability to create connections between worlds.
Now, Shirley Chung has a new restaurant in Culver City. It's called Ms. Chi Cafe. And she has a new cookbook out called Chinese Heritage Cooking from My American Kitchen. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. Okay, so you really believe in that it's okay. Chinese American food is as valuable as Chinese food?
100%. I think everybody always talk about why the traditional Chinese food, there's 8 different regions of China and that each region represent a different flavor. Oh, that's totally true. But what about us Chinese people been living outside of China for hundreds of years? The reason I say that, even though I grew up in Beijing, but then my family, we actually are 5 generations of Chinese American in LA since 1900s. A lot of times back in the days, because the history of immigration and everything else, a lot of Chinese restaurant owners, they don't have the access to get to fresh ingredients.
Right.
Like a lot of more fine dining restaurants. We cannot afford that. But now I feel like everybody all know the importance of fresh food, seasonal food a lot more. So I would like to use just the fine ingredients, be able to produce fresh, wholesome Chinese food in modern time. That's my goal.
So mixing the high and the low.
Yes.
So you'd make like a chop suey, but with really good ingredients.
100%.
Give me an example in your new cookbook of something that you do that is like that, marrying the high and the low.
I think one big thing is my version of beef and broccoli. So instead of buying the lower, cheaper cut and then marinate them, use meat tenderizer. So I actually choose a skirt steak, which is one of my favorite cut when it comes to beef product, and charcoal grill them instead of using a wok. Because I also understand that, like when I first came to America, my kitchen, the home kitchen, didn't have a big burner that would fit wok. We had electric stovetop, and a wok is a pot that has a round bottom. So it doesn't fit in a regular American kitchen. So I learned to use cast iron pan and also grill. By doing that, I understand when it comes to Chinese cuisine is a lot of it is about heat control. So I don't have to have a wok. I can still achieve that. That's why my version of beef and broccoli is actually use charcoal grill. You grill everything. You can still create the wok energy without using a wok. And then using broccolini, I know broccolini tastes a lot better than the regular broccoli you buy from a store. And it grills better. It's just tender. It has that snap. And then pair with a charred red onions for texture. So it's still the same flavor, but it's just a different cut of meat, different ingredients, and then slightly elevate this really classic Chinese American dish that I love.
I want to talk a little bit about your background because you live here in LA and you have worked in the United States for a while, but you were born in Beijing.
Yep.
And your family actually was for many generations in California.
Mm-hmm.
And went back to China. So
yes.
How did that happen?
So my great grandmother she's the first female infant was born in Ventura County.
Really?
Crazy, right? A Chinese female infant that was ever born in Ventura County. And my great-grandfather came from China in the 1900s as an herbalist. He had a wife before, but people don't know that back then the immigration laws, starting 1900, they stopped the migration from China.
Chinese Exclusion Act.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So therefore, my great-grandfather couldn't bring over his oldest son and his original wife, but he still ended up staying in America for a better life and sending money back. So he remarried after his first wife passed away in China. He remarried to my great-grandmother. And that's how the Chung family actually been in LA County for 5 generations already. And then he sent his second son, which is my grandfather, back to Beijing to study medicine. My grandfather met my grandmother in Beijing. And big story, my grandmother led a student revolution, so was wounded by the old Republic government as well as Japanese military. They were trying to escape China. There's a lot of interesting things happened. My grandfather wrote a book about it. But ultimately, they came to the United States in 1941. My grandmother finished her college education, USC, history background. And then my grandfather started practicing. He finished his residency in Harvard University.
As a doctor.
As a doctor, mm-hmm. pediatrician. And then he ended up had a clinic in New York. But when 1949 rolled around, my grandmother decided that he wants to go back to support a new China. So the whole family moved back again. There's a lot. And the politician, and then my grandfather mm-hmm. came back to America because, you know, like the political environment during the 10-year Cultural Revolution, he was accused to be an American spy because he had American passport. So it's another really long story. But that's why that I was born in Beijing, China. I came to the United States at 1993, which is age 17, because my father was actually born in America. He was born in New York. So by birthright, I can become U.S. citizen. My father is a U.S. citizen, and then me and my mom automatically qualified to be a green card holder before I turned 18, become an adult. So the cutoff mark, I came here when I was 1993.
So you went to high school here?
A little bit. So
what
I came
last year?
I finished my high school here, and then I studied business in university in the Bay Area. So I kind of grew up half of my life. My teenage year was in the Bay Area, briefly working in the Silicon Valley because that's what my father's business. He was in semiconductor. So I never liked all this sitting here. I have too much energy to sit in front of a desk. But I did high tech sales. I worked in the Silicon Valley for 5 years or so. Met my husband. And then it was his encouragement that I went to culinary school. So here I am.
Here you are. And then you... Between then and now, you were on Top Chef a couple of times.
Yeah, I started off very high. So I started off externing for French Laundry and working for Bouchon Yangville in Napa with Chef Thomas Keller. But then he's the best chef in the world. TK sent me to Las Vegas to open Bouchon for him. So I was in Las Vegas for 13 years. Opened 6 different restaurants for Chef Thomas Keller, Guy Savoy, Mario Batali for many years, and followed by Jose Andres.
Wow.
So that was my, I quote, shadow chef career. It was amazing.
Okay. And then you end up on TV, and then now you have this restaurant.
I'd be able to have my own culinary voice, and then decided that I do want to cook my own culture. That's where Miss She came from, and then also my new cookbook.
So you talk about modern American with Chinese soul. That's how you describe your cooking. So I was wondering if we could talk about one of the recipes that seems to fit the bill. At least the title of this recipe seems to totally encapsulate that.
100%.
It's called cheeseburger potstickers.
Yep.
So what is a cheeseburger potsticker?
This dish come around is actually because I was on Top Chef for a second time, and it was a challenge by Dominic Ansel, French pastry chef that became so successful in America.
He's the cronut guy, right?
Exactly. He's the guy that created the original cronut. So the title of the challenge is, we challenge you on your creativity. We have 5 minutes to plan the menu, and then they said that they want a brunch item. I immediately think about when it comes to Chinese food, a big part is dim sum, dumplings, all those things that we eat as breakfast, which is very different from a lot of different culture. We eat a lot of savory food during our breakfast. And then for me, I'm a sucker for hamburgers. I love a clean burger with great quality cheese and great quality meat. And especially I'm a Californian, so I'm a big, you know, I love In-N-Out. So so when that whole two idea come together, I was like, okay, so I'm going to use something that from my heritage, which is I can make since I was 6 years old. And I need to cook for 60 people in 90 minutes. So I need to do something that I know I can produce a lot in a short amount of time. I feel very comfortable, make a lot of dumplings. And I can do a cheeseburger filling on the fly too. And I ended up winning the challenge. But when I won that challenge, I feel like I didn't really complete the recipe as well because my meat was a little bit on the dry side. So therefore that I have to include this in my first cookbook.
It looks really, really, really good.
I had that on Miss She Cafe. It was so popular that I have to only serve it during dinner time because my dumpling girls and I, we cannot keep up with the production.
All right. And then you have another recipe here that seems pretty traditionally Chinese, and this is jasmine tea eggs.
Yes.
How do you make a jasmine tea egg?
Tea egg is a either hard-boiled or soft-boiled egg. You boil them first, and after that, you soak them and marinate them in this really aromatic tea and soy and other spice liquid. And then after that, you create this tea egg. I remember I have this grandma that next to my elementary school, and she always have a pot of tea egg stewing in front of her. And then so every single school kid after school, we're hungry and we always go buy a tea egg. So that's a great memory. And in my book, I believe I want to serve them cold so they will never overcook. But at the same time, that is just easier. We all eat a cold hard-boiled egg in the morning as breakfast, as grab-and-go. That's why this is such a classic recipe that close to my heart because I eat that growing up, and then I just change it a little bit. So it's more easier for us as modern people that we don't have time to sit there, stew the eggs, mm-hmm. and we just put them in a jar, let them marinate in the fridge.
And they marinate because the egg is, the shell is cracked. And
yes.
So the marinade gets into the egg that way.
Yeah, so we pre-boil the eggs first, and then after that, take a spoon, crack all the shell, but still leave them intact. So when the tea marinade get infused into the egg, and after you peel them, this egg looks like a little marble with all the pattern and all the flavor of soy and tea solution to create that. So it's really cool to look at it too.
Why not marinate the egg peeled? Why do you keep the shell on it? Is it just for the visual because it looks cool and marbleized?
It looks cool, but at the same time that I think for us, we feel like when you completely submerge that in tea has alkaline, it will continue to cook the egg even more, and so make your skin harder and harder. By having the shell protected a little bit so that you're not sitting there cooking the egg nonstop, it can also help you prevent it that your egg is too flavorful to eat. Because, you know, there's soy. So if you cure this for a really long time without the shell to protect it, you might overcure your egg. But by having the shell there, you can elongate it and leave it in your fridge for 3 or 4 days and still great.
Do you find that purists, like traditional Chinese purists of the food, are they okay with what you're doing? Or are they feeling like, what are you doing with
our they're not
tradition?
Okay with me.
Not at all. Okay.
So like I do this kind of interview a lot, especially when it comes to media, like Chinese media. They always ask, why are you leaving the tradition behind and then do this? So what I would tell them is, yes, we have 8 different regions of Chinese cuisine. But we're living in America. We cannot get exact ingredient from those regions. The reason that it's all separated into 8 different regions, because every single region have different geography, different environment. Therefore, the things that produce and product grow in particular region are different. That's why you create different unique flavor based on geography and everything else. We're in America. So now I want to create Chinese food that's authentic to us, Chinese American. Use local, use what we have, and with authentic flavor. And that can create our own region of Chinese food.
Shirley Chung, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you to have me.
Shirley Chung, she's the founder of Ms. Chi Cafe in Culver City. And she's the author of a new cookbook. It's called Chinese Heritage Cooking from My American Kitchen. Okay, Christian Bordahl is here now, the resident Norwegian.
Hey there.
Hello.
Well, in the spirit of my brilliant friend, the new HBO show that you talked about earlier,
yes.
I asked people whether they have longtime childhood friends in their lives and how that has changed over time. And I got some really nice responses. Michelle Elise says, yes, just a handful of friends that I've known since elementary school. We don't live in the same state, but we still chat via text and social media, sometimes the occasional snail mail packages too, hoping our kids will get to meet one day. Fernando Aquino says, Jonathan Cordova, 22 plus years, strong and going. You're the Bert to my Ernie, LOL. Frost Barnes says, two guy friends from junior high, actually. The friendships remain near effortless, and the levels of honesty and candor we have are always refreshing whenever we get together for a meal or drinks. As I edge into my 50s, I feel very fortunate. And Gachaponke says, being Mexican and from a small town, I went to school with my cousins. As far as non-relative friends go, I will still stay in touch with friends from high school. We drifted apart a bit, but we still talk and hang out when we can. It's kind of the modern world, you know, like everyone moves everywhere these days. And so the question is, like, do you stay in touch with those people that are back from, you know, that you knew when you were in school?
Right. Well, you do have to make an effort. And I guess that is what Facebook is for.
I guess it is,
originally,
yes.
What it was for.
Uh-huh.
And then it was for elections.
Whatever you wanted to turn it into.
Anyway, okay. Thank you very much, Christian Bordahl.
Sure.
My Norwegian friend. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.